Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to keep on top of all the latest news from China through our daily email newsletter, our website, our app, and our growing range of videos and podcasts. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Joining me from his stately Nashville Pleasure Dome, where Alf, the sacred river ran, is a man who dines on honeydew and drinks only the milk of paradise, Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn, of whom it is often said, noting his flashing eyes, his floating hair, all should cry, beware, beware. But actually, he's pretty nice once you get to know him. Oh, Ziyumi, Khan of Khans, greet the people.
Yes, obey, all of you. Otherwise, we're coming with our horses and our weapons that we will scavenge from Kaiser's house.
I shouldn't have smoked that opium before this, right? I'm having these.
No, I guess not.
That was dumb. Okay. Yeah. Anyway.
Yes. Anyway, on this show, one theme we like to explore is China's relations with different geographies around the world. There has been probably a little too much of China-US relations lately, not only on the podcast, but also on our website and newsletter. But hopefully everybody recognizes that the US-China relationship is especially consequential and will forgive us for a little too much US-centric news coverage. But our sister podcast, the China in Africa podcast, covers another of the really important areas of China's relationship with the outside world. And we have also ourselves on Seneca done shows on China, Japan, Eastern Europe, India, a little bit on Southeast Asia, and one fairly recently on Venezuela. So we are attempting to expand our geographical footprint. And today we at last turn to an area that we have never examined at all on Seneca, which is China and the Caribbean. Or do I say Caribbean?
You can say whatever you like. Anyway, with us here to talk about that is Leland Lazarus, a foreign service officer with the U.S. State Department who is stationed in Barbados and covers most of the Caribbean. I say Caribbean. Leland is a Mandarin speaker whose prior postings have included stints at the China desk at the State Department in Foggy Bottom out in D.C., a posting at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, and then in the consular section of the Shenyang Consulate. Leland Lazarus, welcome to Seneca.
Kaiser, Jeremy, it is a pleasure to be here. I am a religious listener to the podcast, so it's an honor to be on the show.
All right.
And I say Caribbean.
Caribbean.
Maybe my Caribbean colleagues would say, you idiot, it's Caribbean. But I guess we'll find out afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, while we're talking about names and pronunciation, you have a lovely name, Leland. Leland, can you tell us a little bit about your career to date? How does a China guy get posted to the Caribbean as a consular officer? Was it in this case because of your China training or something else?
Well, in the Foreign Service, they always say worldwide availability. And that means that no matter what your background is or your specialty was when you joined the Foreign Service, you go, at least for your first two tours, to where the government needs you to go. And so, of course, even though my background, my academic and professional background is with China, my second tour was to the Caribbean. But what's interesting is even though I came here to Barbados thinking that, hey, I was going to take a quick respite from U.S.-China relations, I found out, wow, actually, China's influence is even here in the Caribbean. And so my official title here is the Deputy Public Affairs Officer at the U.S. Embassy in Barbados in the Eastern Caribbean. But because of my background, I also help to analyze China's influence in the region and help to develop a way to counter that influence.
Leland, before we dive in on China and its influence in the region, give us a quick overview first of the actual countries that you cover from your office, and then talk about the COVID-19 situation in Barbados. You just actually left Florida, I guess, and came back to Barbados. What's the situation there with COVID-19?
Kaiser, I left Miami yesterday, returned back to Barbados. So I'm right here in sunny Barbados. You must be envious of me.
I am.
We all of us are.
And you know what? The Caribbean has handled COVID-19 very well.
I'm glad to hear it.
Of course, this is a issue that will remain with us for quite some time, at least until we find a vaccine. So I don't think any place in the world can say that they're 100% cured of COVID-19. But at least Barbados and this region, they were able to shut down their airports very quickly. They stood up a very robust contact tracing team. So when I came to the airport, they specifically, you know, sent me back home, and I have to quarantine for 14 days. And they gave me a thermometer that I need to check my temperature once in the morning, once in the evening. And someone from the Ministry of Health will come once a day to check on me.
Wow, that's great. That's outstanding. So again, what regions do you cover? So obviously Barbados, Antigua.
There are 7 countries in total that the U.S. Embassy in Barbados is responsible for. That's Barbados, Antigua Barbuda, Dominica, Grenada, and then we call them the Three Saints. So St. Kitts and Nevis, St. Lucia, and St. Vincent and the Grenadines. Now, each of them are unique in their own special way, whether it be the food, the culture, relationship with the U.S. I've visited all of them so far, and I can't be biased on which one is the best, but all of them have great beaches, all of them have amazing people, all of them have longstanding relationships with the U.S.
I think I should try to visit them all in turn, especially the beaches.
I think we should just move there.
I'm up for it.
There.
Okay. Hey, well, you know what? Barbados just created a new policy, a 12-month stamp. So anybody who wants to work remotely can work remotely from Barbados for 12 months.
You got a couch?
Welcome invitation, gentlemen.
I'm coming.
All right. I'll book
Here
a flight.
I come. It's either Fiji or Barbados at this point. I have family in New Zealand, so Fiji has certain geographical advantages, but that sounds really good. Leland, can we start with a big picture question from Beijing's perspective? From like a hard-nosed geopolitical Machiavellian perspective, what is it, do you think, that Beijing hopes to achieve in its diplomatic initiatives in the, I'm still going to say Caribbean, because that's how I grew up. Are there valuable resources or is it just support in the UN? Or what does Beijing want?
I think it has to do with a couple of things. So some Caribbean countries, like Jamaica, for example, has bauxite. So the Chinese are trying to just increase their natural resources, whether it be bauxite, aluminum, other natural resources. Another thing is increasing its exports, especially its excess steel capacity, which goes into the infrastructure projects that are in the region. I want to reference Jamaica again. There's a $720 million infrastructure project with the Chinese state-owned enterprise to create the North-South Highway.
Wow.
Right here in Barbados, there is a early 19th century castle that's called Sam Lord's Castle, or Sam Lord's Castle, which had plans to turn it into a resort. and a Chinese state-owned enterprise called Complant is sort of won the rights to that project. But you know, that project has actually been stagnant for quite a bit of time. And the reason for that is issues with labor, how many local Barbadians are actually going to get jobs as opposed to imported labor from China, and an issue in terms of transparency and about the project itself.
These are two problems that China has never encountered before in its dealings with Africa.
Never, absolutely never.
Yeah, God. Same old song and dance.
But one more thing I would add is, I think another thing that makes the Caribbean and Latin America and the Caribbean in general attractive to China is it is in a area of strategic importance for the United States. Mm-hmm. It is an area of strategic importance, increasing strategic importance for China, because it can build key ports so that its ships can pass through, say, the Panama Canal. And again, going back to the need for natural resources.
Okay, so you've given us a little bit of a sense of what China's looking for. I'm sure that there's, you know, votes in the UN is a factor, as Jeremy noted also. And we'll get to the whole Taiwan-related stuff in a bit. But first, maybe let's look at what China has been doing there. Okay, we've talked about this $700 billion highway project. I'm sorry, $700 million highway project in Jamaica. But there's a lot of other infrastructure projects around, and there's pretty large development loan, other forms of development aid. And then give us a sense of what they've so far gotten in return.
So Jamaica, Trinidad and Tobago, Bahamas, Barbados, Antigua, Barbuda, Dominica, and Grenada are all signatories of the PRC's One Belt, One Road initiative. Hmm. And I would say that over the past decade, the Chinese government and Chinese private companies have invested billions of dollars in the Caribbean. I had mentioned that North-South Highway project in Jamaica, but there are also loans that Trinidad and Tobago received in order to create an arts center. I mentioned the Sam Lord's Castle construction project in Barbados. Antigua is another example in which a engineering company called China Civil Engineering Construction Corporation, they built an airport terminal there. I visited Grenada multiple times, and in Grenada there is a housing projects that are built by a Chinese company.
Hmm. There's also massive loans that are going. I mean, it's not in your sector, but. There's a big loan to Trinidad and Tobago. There's a gigantic investment in the Bahamas, which is not in your region. But
what would you say has the Chinese interest in the region and the development assistance? What has been the main way that they have got involved in these local economies? Is it investments is the biggest thing, or loans, or infrastructure for resources deals, or direct aid, or what?
It's been a mix of infrastructure projects and foreign assistance / aid. Our region is unique because it is so vulnerable to hurricanes, right? And so a lot of the countries I'm thinking of, Dominica and Antigua Barbuda specifically, are specifically vulnerable to hurricanes, and they've received aid from China on hurricane resilience in the past. I think another issue is that a lot of these Caribbean countries don't have access to funding from international financial institutions like the World Bank and the IMF. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Well, according to the metrics of some of these international organizations, a lot of these Caribbean countries are considered middle income or high income countries. And so they don't have access to some of those loans that they would otherwise need in order for big infrastructure projects. And of course, in comes China with 20-year concessional loans with just 3% interest rates, right?
Right.
And so it seems quite attractive from a Caribbean country's point of view in order to really create infrastructure projects in their own country.
Now, I remember the Antigua and Barbuda ambassador to the U.S., Sir Ronald Sanders, if I'm remembering right, he wrote an op-ed not so long ago. He was saying basically that, hey, you know, the U.S. should stop with all these warnings to Caribbean governments to limit, you know, their financial dealings. You know, they've been urging them, as you'd expect, to limit their financial dealings with China, talking about, you know, about predatory lending or debt trap diplomacy, right? And he's saying basically, look, look at these terms. I mean, you're talking about, like you said, 20-year loans, 3% interest rate. These countries have always been pawns. So, you know, what does it matter whose money we take as long as we benefit? So, I mean, you definitely hear a lot of the same thing around the global south where China's been active. Is that a pretty common attitude across the Caribbean? And what does the U.S. tend to say in response to this?
So from my perch here in Barbados, I would say that there's a disconnect in the perception of China, say, amongst government officials and amongst the everyday Caribbean people. And why do I say that? Because China's infrastructure projects, their aid, and specifically in the midst of COVID-19, their COVID-19 assistance has been praised by local government officials. Chinese ambassadors in the region have posted positive op-eds about China being a friend. But from our research on media monitoring, we actually see that on social media, any sort of comments that are about China tend to be either negative or tend to be just apathetic about China, that it's seen as a big country far away. They don't necessarily know too much about what happens inside China. They just know that it's a big country that has a lot of money. And so I think amongst the everyday Caribbean people, there is still this suspicion about China's interests and aims in the region.
Sure, sure.
That sounds similar to a lot of what you see in African countries and Southeast Asian countries and Pacific Island nations, where the elites are quite happy to deal with China, but the people writing crap on the internet, maybe not so much.
Right.
No, it's so true. And one thing I wanted to mention is there's a relatively new organization. It's called the Caribbean Investigative Journalism Network. And they had a long article about China's increasing economic influence in the region. And one of the things that's interesting that came out of that article is really looking at the fine print of some of the contracts that some of these state-owned enterprises made with some of these countries. And you read the fine print and you see that, oh, well, if X country does not pay the loan within a certain amount of time, well, then that country needs to give up sovereign immunity for this port or for this project, which is concerning.
It's the Hambantota thing, right?
And, right, right. Exactly. It's really similar to what we were seeing, say, in Sri Lanka with the Hambantota port, in which Sri Lanka, you know, couldn't pay on the, I think it was the $1.5 billion, right? And then China now has a 99-year lease on that port. So from our perspective, our concern, say the U.S., is we don't want our Caribbean partners to be duped by China, right? We want them to meet China with a clear-eyed and transparent manner.
And how... Yes.
I can't imagine that there could be any, you know, State Department funding of this investigative journalism network either.
So how about on the sort of soft, so-called soft power, like the cultural front? I mean, there's a Confucius instant, there's a Confucius Institute at the, in the University of the West Indies. Is that the only one? Is there controversy surrounding it? How do people in the Caribbean or Caribbean feel about China's soft power initiatives?
Well, I can speak specifically for Barbados because I basically have friends in the Confucius Institute, whether it be Barbadian studying Chinese or some of the Chinese teachers themselves. Just for me, I know that there must be so many people out there listening who are just like me, who have lived in China before and tries desperately to maintain his or her fluency in the language, even though they live away from China. And so I frequently go to the Confucius Institute events and so on and so forth. There has been an increase in Barbadian students, Antigua Barbadian students, Jamaican students to China to study the language or study at a Chinese university. But in the main, it hasn't increased in, say, like exponential level, right? Think that just like elsewhere, the Confucius Institute is trying to find ways in order to just teach the local population about Chinese culture and put on events so that people will know a little bit more about China.
So it's not been terribly controversial so far. There hasn't been a sort of movement to get rid of it or anything like that?
No.
Okay, I'm glad to hear it. Because, you know, the Confucius Institutes are under such assault in the West, and not always fairly, I don't think.
Yeah, guys.
I know that there's like a large Chinese community. There's a large diasporic community of Chinese in Jamaica. We've talked about that before on the show. Are we seeing large flows of Chinese migrants to the rest of the area at all? Are there other Chinese communities being established on different islands in the region?
So what's interesting is here in Barbados, I would put there are different groups of, say, Chinese in the region. So one of them are, of course, families of Barbadians with Chinese roots, right? One of my close friends here in Barbados, he is Chinese Barbadian, and his family originally came from southern China to Guyana, and then from Guyana came to Barbados to work. So you've got a group of those Chinese Barbadians. Then you have Chinese workers who are here either for construction projects or for medical brigades. What's interesting is that there's a group of, I think, 10 medical officials from Guangdong province who are here working in Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Barbados. And that's interesting.
Wow. Yeah, that's great.
Then you have something called the Association for Barbados China Friendship.
Ah, is that kind of a united front?
Of course, shop? You go there immediately. And you're probably right.
Well, it is a group of Barbadians who have studied abroad in China or did business in China and are now returned to Barbados. And their main goal is to increase the bilateral relationship. And so one of the clear members is, his name is Chelston Brathwaite, who was the former Barbadian ambassador to China.
Yeah. That sounds totally above board, Jeremy. I don't know. I mean,
oh, yeah,
I think you and your
United... Nothing dodgy going on that.
The United Front, though, I mean, has become... It's like it's to a lot of Westerners what the National Endowment for Democracy is to a lot of Chinese. It's like this, you know, all-purpose
boogeyman.
Sure,
it's a boogeyman you can blame everything on. But yeah, nonetheless, exactly. This operation sounds...
Anyway. I don't know. Because, yeah, because okay. Pursuing friendship,
what
you
I
must
found
be,
interesting is that association, the ABCF, they had a meeting, I think, just a couple of months ago. And what was fascinating was the PRC ambassador to Barbados, he gave the opening remarks, and he specifically said, and we need members of the ABCF to promote the truth about China. For example, the new national security law in Hong Kong has overwhelming support from the local Hong Kong people. We must talk about...
Totally innocent operation, like, obviously, Kaiser.
And
okay, I'm going to give you this one.
And all the great things that China has done in terms of masks, diplomacy, and COVID-19 assistance, that should be spread throughout the country and throughout the region. So...
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
I gotcha. Yeah, Lumen, can you give us an overview of the situation with respect to the recognition of the People's Republic of China or Taiwan in the region you're responsible for? As I understand it, there are still quite a number of the states that recognize Taiwan or the Republic of China on Taiwan as a diplomatic partner. Many of these states are in the region that you are responsible for. Some of these are quite contested, as with the election in St. Kitts and Nevis, where the incumbent is pro-Taiwan, but his challenger is pro-PRC. Can you talk about this dynamic a little bit?
Yeah, Jeremy. I think the Caribbean is an interesting place to look at and analyze the competition between mainland China and Taiwan. Because out of the 15 countries that still recognize Taiwan as an independent country, five of them are in our region. That's Belize, Haiti, and then what I call the three saints, St. Kitts and Nevis, St. Lucia, and St. Vincent and the Grenadines.
Right.
And Jeremy, you hit the nail on the head. Recently, there was a election in St. Kitts and Nevis where the incumbent Prime Minister, Timothy Harris, and the Unity Party are pro-Taiwan. And the opposition, they flirted with the idea that if they were to get into power, they would switch diplomatic relations from Taiwan to the mainland.
Hmm.
Now, ultimately, the election resulted with Timothy Harris staying on, but it gives you a glimpse of the country sort of being on pins and needles when it comes to whether the country will switch during the next administration. St. Lucia is a perfect example, too. I think from 1984 to 1997, it recognized Taiwan. And then from 1997 to 2006, it switched and recognized mainland China. And then from 2006 to now, it switched back to recognizing Taiwan. So
I think there's like fiscal benefits to switching often.
Right? Yeah, probably. But it's also quite kind of interesting that you have a very similar situation in the Pacific, where Pacific Island nations are, I think, are also, I mean, that's where you have the other center of support for Taiwan, and also, you know, some switching back and forth and political jockeying. Do you think that small island countries are more predisposed to be friendly to another small island country of Taiwan? Or why in the Caribbean? Or the Caribbean.
Okay, let's stop that. It's getting old now.
Okay. Do we say, so what do I say though?
Say Caribbean. Say what you're used to.
Caribbean, okay. Why do we see a similar dynamic in the Caribbean as we do in the Pacific Island nations, do you think?
Yeah, I think in this region in particular, dealing with Taiwan brings results. Taiwanese has provided hundreds of thousands of masks and PPE and thousands of PCR tests to the Three Saints in the midst of COVID-19. Even before that, they've provided assistance in the agricultural sector. They fund millions of dollars for students in the Three Saints to go to Taiwan to learn Chinese and to do technical exchanges. And then there's a program called the ICDF, the International Cooperation and Development Fund, which is similar to our Peace Corps, where young Taiwanese volunteers travel to the Three Saints to volunteer in the medical sector, local hospitals.
Oh, cool.
Or to teach Chinese in local schools, or even to help out in terms of public health. So it all goes to the idea that having Taiwan as a partner means that you have a loyal and consistent partner in development. And one thing I wanted to add is, again, because of my background in China, I work closely with my Taiwanese counterparts on amplifying our foreign assistance messages, all of the foreign assistance programs that the Taiwanese do in the region, we amplify in our social media, and vice versa. And we try to help out our democratic partners in the region who are doing good in the region.
Well, that's interesting. So you're saying that the official social media accounts of the U.S. embassies and consulates in the region actually amplify the sort of pro-Taiwan leaning messaging?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, I understand that you're a foreign service officer and you need to, you know, to hew to official American diplomatic positions when it comes to things like Taiwan, but it strikes me that that's more than tacit rooting for a kind of pro-Taiwan stance. And I mean, I certainly during the Trump administration, that whole thing has gotten a whole lot less tacit. But, you know, we do still recognize, you know, a one China policy. I mean, that's got to piss off Beijing, right, when they see you guys doing that.
Well, I think what we do is we're supporting our democratic partners in the region. And so if, for example, the UK provides assistance for COVID-19, we amplify what they're doing. If the EU is donating PPE to the region, we also amplify that message as well. And so we do work closely with our Taiwanese counterparts to amplify each other's messages in order to just show those Caribbean partners and the Three Saints that they are a stalwart and trustworthy ally.
Okay, okay, cool. I mean, I get it. And from the time of the Monroe Doctrine on down, the U.S. has definitely regarded the Caribbean as very much its own backyard, right? I mean, we all know that. I'd be surprised if the U.S. government weren't doing things to sort of actively counter, you know, rising Chinese influence, and if bolstering the Taiwan message is part of it, that doesn't surprise me. What is the U.S. trying to do in that way, by way of sort of, do they have a good counter offer? I mean, I brought up earlier Sir Ronald Sanders in that op-ed that he wrote, the ambassador to the U.S. from Antigua Barbuda. What are we offering? What are we countering with? Are we going head to head against China in terms of the development aid that we're offering or the infrastructure that we're building?
Yeah, I think we're providing a transparent, sustainable, and democratic alternative to China's ambitions in the region. And what does that look like? We have a program called the U.S. Caribbean 2020 Strategy, where we are directing monies to six different sectors: health, education, energy, security, prosperity, and diplomacy. And that comes with actual money. $10 million, for example, for disaster resilience. We have a program called the Growth in the Americas Initiative, where we're really trying to get private investment into the region to help fund some of these infrastructure projects and other projects in order to help these economies grow. But I also think, Kaiser and Jeremy, that there is sort of a shifting view about China's intentions in the region. I had mentioned before that sort of the officials tend to be positive about China's involvement, but sort of the local people tend to be pretty skeptical about it. Mm-hmm. And I think a perfect example of this is recently in the local newspaper in Barbados, a former Barbadian diplomat by the name of Mohamed Deggia, he basically took the Chinese to task in an op-ed about its horrendous treatment of the more than 1 million Uyghurs, right, in Xinjiang.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then the Chinese embassy actually came back with its own op-ed saying, oh, well, you need to check the facts. And so it shows how the Chinese are quite thin-skinned when it comes to any sort of criticism about its internal issues, right?
Yeah, really. Imagine that.
So I think that more and more people are realizing the fact that, well, in terms of values, in terms of political systems, we don't necessarily have that much in common with China. Whereas in the U.S., there are so many Barbadians who live in New York or Florida or Texas and other areas around the United States. And that's true for other countries in the Caribbean, right? So we have a natural familial affinity and natural economic and historical and political ties. And I think that's the kind of alternative that we bring.
There is an issue of competence, of course. And competence is something that the United States has, as much as I love my adopted country, has not displayed a lot of in the last few months when it comes to COVID-19. Has the COVID-19 pandemic had any noticeable impact on the balance between China and the US and the region? Because I can imagine that some of the Chinese infrastructure projects that have been held up because of the epidemic, but the same would be true of the US projects too, I guess. And anybody who's reading the news will be observing our, you know,
our flailing state,
expanding case count here in the US.
I think at the very beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, there was this back and forth, tit for tat, you know, how many masks did you give and how many masks did China give, right? And oh my goodness, well, we just received however many boxes and look what's going on. I think now, I think that the U.S. has by far provided the most money in terms of COVID-19 assistance. And that's just by the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
To the, and specifically like $3 million to a to the Caribbean Public Health Administration, millions of dollars to the Caribbean Disaster and Emergency Management Agency. And you would say that the U.S. assistance is ongoing as opposed to just, you know, one or two time donations, right?
Yeah, I don't know. We'll take your word for it, though.
So basically what you're saying is that it might very well be that at the end of this, the U.S. will come out looking, if not more competent, at least as competent or more generous than China in the
I think in the long run.
Or the generosity makes up for competence.
Yeah, I think in the long run, absolutely. Especially now that we're in the midst of the hurricane season. The U.S. is working closely with our partners right now on disaster resilience. We have a program called the U.S. Caribbean Resilience Partnership, where we really work with our Caribbean partners on pre-positioning a much-needed material when a hurricane hits, right?
Leland, the State Department clearly needs a PR agency because, like, I didn't know about any of this. And I spend, you know, 14 hours a day reading the news.
Well, I mean, the other thing is like, yeah, it's all well and good. But then when we look at the American territory in the Caribbean and how we did with hurricane relief and preparedness with our own, you know, soon to be hopefully 51st state, I can't say that we did particularly well with that. I mean, it doesn't come on, right?
Well, I mean, I want to say the facts still are that we provide a lot of material and aid to our Caribbean partners when it comes to disaster resilience.
Yeah.
Last year, last October, actually, we had a resilience working group where 14 different Caribbean countries all gathered right here in Barbados to plan out, basically create an action plan for the next hurricane season. So I think programs like these make the region more resilient and more prepared for when the next hurricane does hit.
Yeah, so if it extends to Puerto Rico too. Hey, Leland, there's been, you know, I've read about military exercises that the PLA has taken part in different countries of the Caribbean. I've seen, you know, there are Chinese military advisors occasionally in the area. Have PLA Navy vessels ever actually transited in the area, to your knowledge? And I'm just trying to imagine what the American response would be to that.
I don't think that there's ever been any PLA, destroyers or any kind of sort of ships that were military ships that have gone through. I do know that the Peace Ark has passed through for medical missions in recent years, in which case they provided medical assistance in Venezuela, for example, right?
Right, right.
But we also have the USNS Comfort, right? Our naval ship that comes in every few years to the region to provide the same medical care. And actually last year, it passed through Grenada, St. Lucia, and St. Kitts and Nevis, and provided free medical care to more than 14,000 people.
That's fantastic. That's great. That's great. No, I mean, if it's going to be competition between the United States and China about who can do more good with their medical ships, I think that's the kind of competition I want to see. Anyway, Leland Lazarus, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. I totally look forward to having you back on the show again soon. Let's move on to our recommendation section, but first, a word about how you, the listener, can help us out. Dear Seneca podcast listeners and fans, we were grateful to be able to celebrate the 10th anniversary of our podcast with you guys, and I hope many of you caught that and enjoyed it. We've come a long way since our early days in Beijing in that crude and cruddy studio. We are delighted that so many of you have come along with us on this ride. Today, SubChina is home not only to Seneca, but to 8 other podcasts under the Seneca Network, and we've racked up about 250,000 downloads each month. That makes us pretty proud. But we would like to do even more, and we need your help. In celebration of our 10th anniversary, we're launching a fundraising campaign to support our ongoing podcast efforts. We appreciate your showing your support, especially during these difficult days of the COVID-19 pandemic, so please, don't be shy. If you have valued the podcast and would like to see us continue to bring you wide-ranging interviews with the top people in the China field, please show your support. All the funds raised will go to support our team. We get to do the fun part, which is interviewing the guests, doing the research, and writing our questions. But we have many other hosts working hard on the other network shows. We have Jason, who tackles the editing and sound engineering on many of the network shows, making them sparkle. And we have Jeremy's editorial team, which does all the back-end support and works to get the shows up on the platforms like iTunes and Spotify and on all the right podcast apps. So help us out. This is the first time in a decade we have asked for any direct financial support. Show us that you value what we're doing and that you've learned something from our work and that we've made a difference in your understanding of China. Go to podcast.supchina.com. That's podcast.supchina.com and help us out. Thank you so much. Okay, now on to recommendations. Jeremy, what you got for us this week?
Okay, so I got a book called The Secrets of Snakes, The Science Beyond the Myths by a biologist named David A. Steen, or as I would pronounce it, Steen, which means stone in Dutch and Afrikaans. And he is also on Twitter at Alongside Wild. And one of the great things, I've just started the book on the snakes, which is very nice. And it's mostly about North American snakes, but I think anybody all over the world who's interested in animals will find it interesting. But one of the great things about David Steen is that if you tweet him a photo of a snake, he will help you to identify it. And I don't know if he can do this for snakes on Barbados, but he probably can.
So. Oh, wow. I want to check this guy out. I mean, I just noticed he has 45,000 followers. I think there's probably like this whole wildlife Twitter that's probably a lot nicer than China Twitter, huh?
It's a lot nicer than China Twitter. Wildlife Twitter is very sweet. Wow. China Twitter has become, well, we all
know.
I think most of our listeners know, but it's pretty nasty. I even hate people I love on China Twitter. I mean, it's just...
Yeah. I know the feeling.
I hate myself on China Twitter.
Okay, that's great. The Secrets of Snakes, The Science Beyond the Myths. I killed a snake recently in my garden.
You mean person.
He was a copperhead. It was like a totally poisonous mother. I mean, anyway.
Just pick it up and put it
right,
somewhere
pick
else.
Pick it up. No, I'm not going to pick up the snake. I mean, you and your people in that part of the country are snake handlers, maybe. But
yeah, not I'm not sure if I would get close enough to the snake to even take a picture to send it to this guy.
Leland, what you got for us? Recommendations.
I've got two recommendations, really three.
Oh, excellent.
So one is Gushi FM, which is a podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. Fantastic. Seconded.
It's a great sort of podcast for, again, everyone like me out there who are China scholars but living away from China and desperately trying to maintain our fluency. This is a great sort of tool. It's about 30-minute episodes of really interesting stories. I mean, I think a recent episode was of a normal Chinese guy who just left it all to go and serve in the French Foreign Legion.
Oh, wow.
Or a Chinese lady who spent, I think, many years in Afghanistan and sort of figuring out Afghan culture. So it's a really interesting podcast. So I would recommend that. Second recommendation is for any scholars of color who are interested in Asian sort of politics, specifically China, there's a new organization called the National Association for Black Engagement in Asia, NABEA. And it's a repository of Black experts on Asian issues, China, Korea, Japan. So if you guys haven't checked it out, definitely check it out. See if there are any experts who could also be on the show.
Oh, that's fantastic. And it reminds me that we're, you know, in August, we're going to be taping a show with Mark Akpaninye, who's at, he's a China scholar who has put together this Black China Caucus. Mm. And they've put out this survey right now to try to get people to sign up for a list of China specialists in different areas who are people of color, specifically who are Black Americans and not just Americans, Black people around the world who study China. So make sure you get on that list. And we're also going to have Keisha Brown, who's at Tennessee State University, on that show joining us as well. And, you know, we'd love to have you back for that as well, Leland. That would be great to
have
you on.
That would be fantastic. And I think the last thing is, if anyone out there is interested in, say, the Foreign Service or thought that this sort of job might be interesting, definitely go to careers.state.gov. It has been a very interesting ride over the past 5 years thus far. And so
I bet
from northeastern China, right near the China North Korean border, to sunny Barbados, but still focusing on China relations, it has been a wild ride, let me tell you.
Sign of the times. Absolutely sign of the times.
I mean, if I could get security clearance, I would totally want your job, but I don't think they would have me.
Well, me neither. I don't think I'd make it. Yeah. So my recommendation, I was introduced to a Beijing band that it was just, I guess, they put out their first album right before I left China. But they play a type of heavy metal that I've always kind of championed and which I guess I was associated with. I mean, it's Chinese folk metal, which means heavy metal that has a lot of, you know, traditional instrumentation or a lot of sort of Chinese musical motifs or ideas. This band, which is called Chuge, is really terrific. Chu, as in the state of Chu, as in Simian Chu Ge, the songs of Chu, right? The Chu state, of course, during the Warring States period, was one of the most powerful of these, and it was really quite culturally distinct. It was centered in Hubei and in southern Henan, but it was, you know, a really large state. It covered the whole sort of center of China. The saying refers to this decisive battle during the Chu-Han contention, where, you know, this general named Han Xin, who was, you know, one of Liu Bang's top generals, he had sort of cornered the hegemon of Chu, Xiang Yu, and had his troops sing the songs of Chu to make them believe that they had already lost, basically. Anyway, the music is just really amazing. It's super riffy. It's grooving. They have a fantastic drummer. But it's also got this really kind of deathy intensity. The vocalist is really versatile. He sings and sings really well, has a good range, but also does a lot of the growl stuff that not everyone likes, you know, the Cookie Monster stuff. But it has a lot of really deep musicality to it. I think anyone who's a musician would really appreciate how really musical these guys are. I think they're all Chinese except for one who's a Norwegian. One of the guitarists is Norwegian.
Of course.
Yeah, that's metal. Right?
A Chinese death metal band. Of course it needs a
metal. Oh, come on. There are plenty of death metal bands without any lawais. Anyway, a lot of bands have tried and failed to do this sort of, you know, bringing in the Chinese elements, but these guys, I think, succeed pretty unequivocally, at least in my book. So you can find their album, which is called Yanhuang, you know, like the fire phoenix, or the lava phoenix, or whatever, on YouTube, and you can, you know, check them out, find this band Chuge, and support them. Like they're really, really, really talented. I haven't found a metal band from China that I love in a while, and I've been very excited. Anyway. Leland, once again, thank you so much. And, you know, best of luck to you in your career. And we'll talk to you again in a few weeks, it looks like.
Thank you, sir. It was a pleasure. Jeremy, it was a pleasure. Kaiser.
Thank you, Leland.
Stay safe and healthy. Jeremy, as always, a pleasure.
Yeah, I think you're fine in Barbados.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, still open invitation. I think, you can work.
All right, man. Just, you got a futon, right. I'm there, man.
Do they let Americans in right now? Can
you
we
know,
go there?
14-day quarantine.
You know, commercial flights from the U.S. may open as early as September.
Okay.
I can maybe, you know, hang out a couple more months in this, but then I'm there. I'll bake bread for my rent. Okay, guys. Take care.
All right.
Take care.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.